Welcome to Planet Geo, the podcast where we talk about our amazing planet, how it works, and why it matters to you. Let's see how it goes. Let's see what this turns into. Okay, Chris. Well, first of all, I have to say, there's a way that Chris Bolaise comes into the Zoom room. Do you know this? Do you know the look you give when you come into the room?
Was I grumpy?
No. You're rarely, if ever, grumpy when we are doing Planet Geo. I mean, you know that.
Yes.
You're not.
I'm happy.
Sometimes you need to vent a little bit at the start of something, but.
Well, I do have some venting to do today.
Oh, good. Well, we'll get to that. But let me first say, you come in with, it's Chris Bolaise's rock hunting focused look. It's this.
I know what's going on now. I know exactly why I'm doing that. It's because I have my three screen setup. And when I first come on, if you beat me to the punch and you're already on,
you're looking for me.
I come in and I'm looking around trying to get everything situated. And I just don't want you to talk to me at that point. I just leave me alone. Let me get everything situated.
Tightly furrowed brow, pursed lips, intently focused. I mean, it's the Chris Bolaise, like, focused on something. Don't mess with me.
I am going to have a little sip of bourbon. Cheers, man. Cheers to you,
cheers
Jesse.
Cheers to you. Okay, so this is going to be a fun episode. I want to hear the vent, but this is going to be a fun episode. This is a free-flowing episode that we've really not talked about. This is just kind of unstructured. So we figured, hey, let's have a glass of bourbon and let's talk about one of our favorite topics.
That's right.
What do you got to vent about today, Christopher Balhuis?
Oh, my gosh. So on Sunday, it was beautiful weather.
Yeah, we've had some glorious weather recently, too.
So nice. And so we got everything situated in the morning. I think you and I met. We had some business to discuss and so on. And so then I loaded up our bikes. I pumped up all the tires, put the bike rack on, loaded up our bikes. We were going to go for a long bike ride. We get there. It's like a half hour drive. We get there and my tire is flat. So I had pumped it up before we left. So that's a problem.
Do you have tubes or tubeless tires? What's your...
No, I have tubeless. I have tubeless, okay. Yes. Anyway, that's a problem. I can't fix it right there. I just don't have what I need. I wasn't expecting this at all. In fact, we'd all gotten, like, we got our clip-in shoes on. We got our helmets strapped in.
You're ready.
Last thing I'm doing is I'm ready to go. And I saddle up and I'm like, uh-oh. I got a flat tire. So
it's you and Jenny?
We end up, just Jenny and I. And we came home. And so today was my day that I'm going to fix this thing. So I get everything I need. You know, I have a tool that I had to go buy because I didn't have it yet. The core remover tool, you know. Anyway, I could not get that tire to seat on the rim for the life of me. Oh, my gosh. So it took me literally 2.5 hours to change a tire.
Oh, my goodness.
On my bike.
That's
frustrating. Not fun. It was very frustrating.
Those things that should be 2-minute tasks, but there's some new technology involved and, you know, you got to figure it out. Like it's, it doesn't work that well. I must say, I mean, I don't bike. This is road biking that you guys are doing, right? You and Jenny?
Yeah, it's
road cross biking, country kind of. Well, at least you can get out on it, this coming weekend. You'll be ready to go. Jenny won't be pissed at you. Because I called you later in the day with a random half-baked idea. And I got Jenny on the phone. And Jenny, first thing she says is, well, Jesse, we were going to go biking. But Christopher just didn't have his... Christopher's bike was... We had a flat tire, so we couldn't go. So,
well, you know the Bolaises. We adjusted on the fly. And it was such a beautiful day that you called. What you got was the result of Jenny and I sitting on the back deck. We were sitting in our Adirondack chairs, and we had 2 gin and tonics.
That was definitely a result. You know, going back to a conversation we've had on this podcast about how there's no real rails in place in the Bolaise household. There's nobody keeping you two in check. Within 2 seconds of me picking up the phone, I was like, okay, they've been at it again. The Bolaises have been at it again over there. Just too funny.
We have fun.
Absolutely.
We have fun.
It was good.
We made the most of the day.
And so, if you're listening to this, you're driving through Huntsville, Michigan someday, call up the Bolaises. Just swing by because it's bound to be a good time.
Don't swing by.
Okay. So Chris, today we decided, this is a listener question. This comes from Jamie. Jamie asked, he kind of asked Chris about the 25 rocks that you've talked about on this podcast that you teach your students? And it, sort of the question was like, could you list them? And we thought, well, yes, we can list them, but it's much more interesting to kind of talk about why. And I think, Chris, we talked about scripting something out here or not, but we decided not to because this is pretty like in our wheelhouse. And I think it's going to be an interesting conversation because there's some differences in what you teach, what you require students to know, what I have the ability to require students to know. But then also, like, what do we think about the valuable rocks? Like, what are really, if you're a passionate, you know, if you're a trained geologist, that's one thing. But if you're like a passionate amateur geologist, what are the rocks you really need to know? Well, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. There are so many niche rocks that we could get into that, you know, you just, but it's well beyond the scope. So I try to just think about, all right, what are the basics? What do I want really everybody to know in terms of like what rocks are out there and what common rocks are out there and what do they tell you?
Yeah. What do they tell us? That's exactly right.
It's not naming the rocks and saying, oh, that's a sandstone. That's not what's important. What's important is knowing that that's a sandstone or a quartz sandstone, because then what does that mean? What was the depositional environment? What was the interpretation of that rock then?
But you got to get it right at the outset, right? You got to know, you kind of got to narrow this down and figure out how to kind of identify this. And so a couple points here before we get started. First, we've done an episode on how to identify rocks that gives kind of an overview of this. You can go back and listen to that, but that's kind of more like a strategic, you know, what kind of questions should you be asking yourself if you pick up an unfamiliar rock in the field? We'll touch on that briefly, but really we're going to talk more about the actual rocks you should probably know or you should learn about. One quick plug is that if people ask us how they can kind of support the podcast quite a bit, there's two ways. One is Camp Geo. Go to our app. That's the first link in your show notes. And we talk about these rocks. We talk about almost all of these rocks. Actually, we do. We talk about all these rocks. We have chapters there. It's free content. We have the images, importantly, on the Camp Geo app. So you have free content, basically the intro to geology class that Chris, you teach and at the high school level and I teach at the college level. Same class, same content. We have that in audio discussion form with the images you need. So first link in your show notes, you can go there. We also have the Geology of Yellowstone, Geology of Grand Canyon, and Earth's Climate that you can purchase there right now. So that's one way to support us. You can also head over to our website, planetgeocast.com, and there's a support us link there. So those are just two ways to support us. And I wanted to touch on the stuff that we cover, and because the second follow-up point here, Chris, is that we're going to have another episode, which is in the weeds, which is sort of the rocks you don't need to know, but you might come across, like these accessory right. ones, right? Because there's thousands of different kinds of rocks. We're going to focus on the ones you need to know right now, or what we think you need to know, right? And we're going to format this by, I'm going to kind of interview you. You sent me a list of the rocks that you require students to know. But at the outset, Chris, I'm curious how this list has changed over the 55 years you've been teaching this class.
Okay, all right.
No, but seriously,
it hasn't.
Has it? And if so, how?
That's a good question. It hasn't changed a ton. And I'll say that the changes that have taken place are a result of changes in things that pop up on my Grand Valley exam from Dr. Steve Maddox.
Oh, interesting. Okay, right. That's right. I've forgotten that point. And for people, just as a backstory here, students, myself included, we got college credit, and a bunch of local colleges and regional colleges will give college credit because at the end of Chris Bolhuis's high school geology class, you take the Grand Valley State University exam and then you get credit for it. So that's what you're referring to. How has that changed over the 20 years you've been doing it?
The test changed with respect to major format in that when we first started doing this, it was all short answer, fill in the blank. It was what's the name, what's the texture, and what's the interpretation of each rock? What's the environment of formation? Now, the test is all multiple choice. And that's just because it's gotten big, right? He has so many tests and he has to grade. It's just impossible for him to do this. So he can just run them, you know, he can scan them and it's good to go.
So people will get a rock sample in their hand and it'll be like, is this diorite? Is this gabbro? Is this sandstone? You know, which one? Pick which one it is.
He'll often do is he'll ask about the name and then he'll ask about the interpretation of that rock.
You know, so
one sample, and he'll ask anywhere from 2 to 4 questions about that sample.
Okay. Gotcha.
In a multiple choice format, which I thought when we made that transition that I'm like, oh, my students are going to nail this. And I have found that they don't do any better on a multiple choice test versus the free response test.
I mean, that's interesting that it's changed because the rocks haven't, like the important rocks haven't changed.
Yeah, sometimes he adds things in and it'll stay there for a while. Like he recently added metaconglomerate or like pudding stone to the list, which I found interesting and curious. Maybe it's just because it's fairly common in Michigan to have those rocks. I think
let's talk about that when we get to that one, because that is one that certainly stood out on this list to me.
Yeah,
as you know, like, yeah, I wonder about that. Interesting. Yeah. That's one I certainly don't require. So let's start out with the obvious ones, I guess, Chris, and let's start out with the igneous ones. It's our home turf. We've taken a little bit of heat from listeners for being interested in igneous and metamorphic rocks above all else, but let's start out there nonetheless. And I'm going to group six together as a category because we talk about these a lot on the Camp Geo app. You know, these are the typical ones. It's granite rhyolite, diorite andesite, and gabbro basalt. Those six. I think this is fairly short, but what are those? Why do they require short and brief, you know, dirty elevator pitch for them?
I think of those rocks as being a part of a family. You have the felsic family, which in petrology, you think of felsic as being light colored, rich in quartz and feldspar and so on. So granite and rhyolite are the felsic family. And then you have the intermediate family, where you have a pretty good mix of felsic minerals and some mafic minerals. And if you think back to Bowen's reaction series, it ties nicely into that. And then you have the mafic family with gabbro and basalt. That's the way I think of those. And so when I talk about this with the kids, I'll just bring them back into lab and I'll have a big box of like really good big samples and I'll lay them out that way. I'll put granite next to rhyolite, and then down below it, I'll put diorite next to andesite, and then I'll put gabbro next to basalt. And so you can see on one side, I've got them all lined up, right? Six rocks all lined up in pairs. One side is intrusive, slow cooling, one long, slow cooling rate. That's the typical interpretation. And that would be, you know, granite, diorite, and gabbro. And then the other side would be the extrusive version of those. And that would be then rhyolite, andesite, and basalt. So I'm like, you know, guys, take your phones out and take a picture of it. It's mentally, that's just good organization, I think, for them to be able to see them laid out that way.
I would agree completely with that. And these are, I mean, granite rhyolite, these are the lighter colored ones. These are like grays to whites, pinks, something like that. Rhyolite can be a ton of different colors, but generally on the lighter end of the spectrum. And then diorite and andesite, these are the intermediate ones. These are the kind of salt and peppery ones. And then we've got gabbro and basalt. Gabbro can be salt and peppery, but you know, it's pretty dark overall, dark colored. Gabbro's a weird one in the field because the feldspar, the plagioclase feldspar, weathers to a really chalky white. So it looks really like black and white checkerboardy kind of in some ways, but it's actually a really mafic rock. Anyway, so you kind of go from light to dark in those. And these are really, I think of these as kind of like the fundamental rocks of the earth, because granite is broadly the composition of the upper continental crust. The intermediate rocks, andesite and diorite, those are the composition of like the lower part of the continental crust and some parts of the oceanic crust. And then you've got gabbro and basalt that are the oceanic crust. I mean, it's the mafic rocks, they're the oceanic crust. So this is like kind of the fundamental starting point of Earth's rock cycle, at least in my biased igneous petrology view of the world, right?
So can I ask you a question though about this? And so you would think, based upon Bowen's reaction series and based upon the way that you get granite is by just distilling rock after rock after rock, and you end up with more and more and more felsic. Then why, from your perspective, is diorite not more common? Because it's not a super common rock in the field.
It's not a super common rock in the field. And I think that's in part because, well, so the average, people who've tried to make chemical averages of the continental crust would say that the average composition of the continental crust is andesitic or dioritic. So we see a lot of basalt and we see a lot of granite on the surface.
Right. And the two reason, most common rocks on the crust.
Yep. Exactly. The reason that we don't see diorite, thought being, is that diorite's all down in the middle of the crust. It's all down 10, 15, 30 kilometers down in the crust, and we just don't get to see that very much. And when we do get, like, there are places south of the Sierra Nevadas, the Sierra Nevada batholith has been tilted. So it's a preserved sort of cross section of a subduction zone system. And you get a look down into the lower parts of this crustal, what they call transcrustal magma system, 30 kilometers of an active subduction zone system. And it's been tilted, frozen in place and tilted. And down there, you get a lot of diorite at the base of these arc
systems. Just not a very common rock to see in the
field. That's right. I agree. It's really uncommon. You're much more likely to see gabbro than diorite typically. So
yeah, I see diorite, you know, when we go to Glacier National Park, there's that massive, impressive, you know, sill, this igneous intrusion that runs right through one of the upper layers of the limestone. And it's amazing, but it's just not very common.
It's not very common. So those six are kind of the framework, right? Granite, rhyolite, diorite, andesite, gabbro, basalt. Those are the fundamentals. Now, I'm going to jump a little bit around here, Chris, but we're still in the igneous category. I want to talk about peridotite real quick. Peridotite, we talk about this in the Camp Geo app in the Igneous Rocks chapter for sure. But what do you talk about with peridotite?
I think it's important to show my students peridotite because I talk about it from the context of, all right, here's your look at the mantle.
You know, yes.
It's super important layer of the earth. Here's what it looks like. And you said that gabbro can, you know, look different in the field. You know, it's really a mafic rock, but it can kind of have that salt and peppery look to it. Even it's really mafic, typical, you know, really good lab specimen, when you hold it next to peridotite, then you can really see the difference between mafic and ultramafic.
That's
important to show the students, right? Is you think this is, you know, mafic? Well, look at this one right here. And they're like, oh my gosh.
This rock is dark brown and black and dark green, right? There's no feldspar. There's no quartz. This is just pyroxene and olivine, and that's it. That's a really important rock. And, you know, those are, I would agree, we include that in our, you know, rocks they need to know in the physical geology class that I teach. There's one that's not on this list, which is komatiite, which we talked about in the Camp Geo thing, which is the extrusive equivalent of peridotite. Well, kind of. It's ultramafic, but it's a lava. And it's not commonly talked about in intro courses, even though it fits this kind of family categorization you've made. It would be the, you know, the missing part, the extrusive ultramafic rock in this view would be number 8, but it's really only common from the very early earth, from the older than 2.4 billion years ago, I would say. And so it's just not one you come across in the field. So I think that's why it's not included in this list.
I don't include it because it's very niche in its setting. It's, you know, its geologic setting. It's not a very common rock. And the other thing is, it's not going to show up on Dr. Maddox's exam. Not to say that I teach beyond what he's going to throw at my students. My kids are exposed to way more. But that's just, I don't know, you have to draw the line somewhere, you know? I teach porphyritic andesite, but I don't teach phonolite porphyry.
Right. Well, but phonolite porphyry is a rock you're, as a normal run-of-the-mill geologist or interested person, you're going to come across phonolites a lot more than you're going to walk across komatiites. Komatiites are a very, to your point, very niche rock, even though they fit this kind of categorization quite nicely.
It does.
It's pretty niche as far as the distribution on Earth. So there's a few on here, Chris, that I certainly don't cover because, you know, we only have a semester and we have one lab on igneous rocks for these three here. And I want to get your take on them and which of these are kind of like personal interest versus possibly on the exam or, you know, why you cover these ones. Obsidian, pumice, and scoria. Why do you talk about these, I guess? You personally, I would say.
Okay, absolutely. Pumice is just an interesting rock.
I hate pumice.
Yeah, you should because, you know, you are one of the most gifted students that I've ever had. And I think you only got one question wrong on the Grand Valley exam and it was pumice. And I'm like, really, Jesse, I was staring at you. You were beating yourself up over this, but it was free response. The word I think just escaped you, which I just don't understand because it's a gimme. It's a gift.
I remember exactly where I was sitting in that class. Yeah. My memory, as you know, Chris, is horrendous. Terrible. but I have a few bad memories that are imprinted that I, you know, you can just, I just remember everything about it. I remember where I was sitting in that class. I remember the exam on the lab tables, rocks getting handed around, you know, you got a certain amount of time, et cetera. And then you, I think at that point you gave extra time. You could kind of go back to whichever ones you wanted a little bit extra time on. And I sat there.
I just don't believe time should be a factor. So I give everybody the time they need.
So I had what, five minutes. I'll make you up a number, 3 minutes, something to look at the rock, answer the, as you said before, a couple questions. And I was just sitting there being like, I can't effing think of the word. I know exact, this rock floats. It's felsic. It's vesicular. I just can't remember the name of the rock. And then I went so back to it.
You
and
got
then,
two and, out of 3 points on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you came back to me and you came back because you were like, anybody want any more time to go look at stuff? And I was like, yeah, I got to go look at this other rock. And you, I remember you sidled past me and you're like, I think you said something to the effect of, if you haven't remembered it now, do you think you're going to remember it? And I was like,
I was just probably dumbfounded
not,
by
probably not.
How this,
it's, it is the only thing I missed on that exam.
But so I teach pumice because it is a niche rock, but it's not uncommon.
That's true.
It's a tortured igneous rock, and it has that really tortured look to it. It's explosive. It's got a really cool story. I love pumice. You know, you and I remember walking across the pumice field at St. Helens. Oh, and we're punting rocks. And
so cool.
Like, it's crazy, you know? It, yeah.
I mean, pumice, so all these are lava-based rocks, right? And they're a lot of, they're glassy. Obsidian is very glassy. It's all pure glass. And I think people kind of know what obsidian is. We've talked about it all. Actually, we talked about it a lot in our, in the Yellowstone, Geology Yellowstone audiobook on our Camp Geo app. We talked a lot about obsidian and how it's such a valuable, you, you describe it as the MVP of rocks for Native American communities, right?
Absolutely.
And then pumice and scoria are just felsic and mafic varieties of vesicular. They have gas bubbles in them, very frothy magma that ends up crystallizing as glass. And I agree, Chris, it's an amazing rock. I was just walking across scoria last year at Craters of the Moon. You know, you have all this, these huge cinder cones just pop up and they end up having scoria everywhere.
And that stuff at Craters of the Moon, that blue dragon basalt, it has titanium in it and it oxidizes to this like peacock kind of look. It's amazing basalt. It's world class.
Well, it's absolutely world class. So those three, I guess one thing I'm genuinely curious about is how much of this do you teach? In part because you know that you're going to get a significant fraction of your geology students who go on the summer science trip. And you're going to go to places like Yellowstone where you have tons of pumice and obsidian around.
No, that's not a thought.
Oh, really?
I don't think about that. No, I don't. I don't think about that at all. If I was going to do that, then I would definitely add phonolite porphyry to my repertoire of rocks because we come across that at Devil's Tower. I have far more students that take my geology classes than I can take on summer science.
Yeah, so for sure. I know that.
It's just not a thought.
Okay. All right. I think that covers, that's the igneous rocks you cover. And we're going to, again, we're going to talk about things like phonolite in a, another episode. We're going to save the rocks you don't necessarily need to know, or don't, you don't necessarily need to know. Let me put the emphasis in the right place there, in another chapter. So let's move on to sedimentary rocks, Chris, which are back to our interpretations. I think sediments, to your point about, it's not about identifying the rock. It's about identifying the rock so that you can tell a story about the planet. These are maybe the most important, or sedimentary and metamorphic are much more useful in this category than igneous. Like, igneous is kind of useful, but if you can identify a sandstone versus a shale, that tells you a dramatic difference, right? In the, what the earth was doing back in time.
Absolutely. The interpretation, the depositional environment is very, very specific for these sedimentary rocks. I think that tells a beautiful story. I love that.
I guess my point is if you get a rock and you think it's a granite, but it's really an andesite, your geological interpretation of that difference isn't going to be massive. You're not going to be massively wrong about the tectonic setting. If you look at a conglomerate and you think it's a shale, you're going to be way off in like the prior setting, right? So on that note, I'm going to kind of go through here. Conglomerate and breccia. These are the big coarse-grained ones. I mean, these are typical, yes, in intro classes, would you say? Are these typically covered?
I would hope so. I would hope so. Maybe perhaps not breccia. Breccia is spelled B-R-E-C-C-I-A. And the most common, I ask my students when I throw that up on the screen and I say, what do you think? What does this word sound like?
Yeah.
They always say Breccia Breccia.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's been a recent one, Breccia. And I'm like, no, it's Breccia, like you betcha.
Oh, hey,
you Breccia.
That's a good one. Yeah. I'm going to steal that. That's a very good one. So you said something interesting there. I want to know why. You thought that Breccia might not be. Why do you say that? Might not be, you know, typical in igneous, introductory classes. Why do you say that?
I think Breccia is more niche in its environment of formation. You know, Breccia is just like conglomerate. We're talking about sedimentary rocks that have big pieces in it. Gravel size pieces and cobble size pieces, and they're big, and that indicates really high energy deposition, such as like a fast moving river and things like, or the hard deposits, right? Things like this that are very high energy. But Breccia, the pieces are angular, they're not rounded. And so you have a high energy environment, and there's just very little transport before deposition and then lithification. You know, we have some in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, as soon as you cross the bridge and you go into St. Ignace, you have this limestone collapse breccia. And this is just where groundwater made little caves, and the caves formed sinkholes and busted up all this limestone, and then it got lithified right there in place. And so it's a beautiful rock. I love it.
It's a beautiful rock.
Yeah.
Breccia is just some of the coolest rock out there, I think. I mean, just 2 months ago, there's this amazing rock that's exposed around this sort of eastern Pennsylvania down into Maryland, Virginia, these basins. They're like 500 ma. These are extensional environments where there were obviously high relief created, and then basically these downdrop blocks formed. And so you have this breccia, but it's lithified by limestone. So it's a limestone breccia, and it's deep red, super oxidizing environment with totally cool, sharp, angular clasts. They're all different kinds. It's just it's like an alluvial fan deposit, just unbelievable rock. And it's amazing the exposure. Like you'll find there'll be a huge package of it, and then, you know, 100 meters down the road, it's gone. Like it's gone from the sequence. You just lose it. Cause it's this really, I mean, you think of this stuff like a cave collapse breccia. That's only forming in a really local environment. It's not forming over the entire continental shelf all at one time, right? This is a really local deposit. So anyway, okay, I'm rambling. Here's the point. I'm trying to tell our listeners, we like sedimentary rocks. Sedimentary rocks are cool.
We do. Yeah, they absolutely are. And I think it's important to pair conglomerate and breccia together, because then you can see, all right, well, these are both high energy because of the pieces that are in the rock. And that's the thing that I have to convey to my students. Don't look at the rock. You look at what's inside the rock.
Hold on. I want to double click on that for the listener. This is a really, really, that's a great tool right there for sediments. As soon as you identify it as sediments, go back to our How to Identify Rocks chapter. We talked about like, okay, you got to decide, is it igneous, sedimentary, or metamorphic? That's like the first thing. If you decide it's sedimentary, don't look at the rock, look at the pieces in the rock. I'm stealing that. That is a great phrase, Chris. Amazing.
And that's why, you know, hand lenses or little field microscopes can be super handy for this, because then you get to look at how these grains interlock with each other, or the fact that they don't interlock. And that all of that is very telling in terms of, well, what kind of rock am I looking at?
Oh, my
goodness.
You know,
is this, you know.
So that's a good point you bring up, Chris. And I think, you know, we're going to work through sediments here from high energy, large grains in the rock to low energy. That's kind of the order we're working in here. So this brings us to the next set of two. And I'm curious about this one, because this is one that, well, certainly I don't teach this to the intro to geology class. There's a sedimentologist who teaches another section, and she might talk about this, but I'd be surprised. We're talking about quartz sandstone and Arkose sandstone. Why do you, well, sandstone first, and then why do you tease apart the differences in sandstone here?
Okay. So I need to back out of this just one more step and say that in lecture, when I cover just sedimentary rocks, I actually cover three sandstones. I cover quartz sandstone, which is well sorted. Then I cover the Arcos sandstone, which is only moderately sorted. And then I cover wacky sandstone or gray wacky sandstone.
So you cover the ternary, the sort of ternary diagram of sandstones. Okay. Interesting.
I do.
That was one question. Is my question, when I looked at this list, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. He's separating sandstone, but not into the traditional three. You're separating him into these two. So
I do that from a knowledge standpoint, but I don't do it in the lab setting because wacky sandstone is very niche and there's not a lot of it. I don't have a lot of it myself. I don't have enough of it where I want to let my students destroy it in a lab because that's what happens, right? They just wreck rocks.
Yes.
Okay.
And great point.
So I don't want to do that with them, but here's why I tease them apart and why I keep Arcos in the mix is because it gives me an opportunity to talk about sorting and what that means. Sorting, I don't know, for whatever reason, Jesse, can be a difficult concept, at least for my students. I don't know if it's an age thing. I don't know if you find this to be the case, but I certainly do. They struggle with it.
Yeah. Can I ask a quick question on that? Because I teach this with regard to maturity. I kind of lump all of the sediments under this umbrella of maturity and a bunch of different categories where sorting is one category within there. But I think it's a really important point you bring up that sandstones, you're teasing, this is the ability to kind of tease this apart. And so I'm curious about that difference. Do you have, I guess what I'm thinking is, do you have a case study or an example? Do you talk about the Mississippi River? Do you talk about some setting that, you know, you can draw an analogy for this? Because I agree, it's a really hard topic. How do you get it across?
I use Skittles. I do.
Of course. Of course you do. Chris Bliss, Mr. Skittle himself.
So here's what I did. I've only done it once. It was just this year. I actually woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking about this and I'm like, I'm onto something. This is a good idea. So I went out and
get me a big ass bag of Skittles.
No, I did. I think I bought 15 pounds of Skittles. Okay. I bought 3 5-pound bags. Okay.
That's so good.
The things that we spend money on as teachers is crazy.
So good. Oh my goodness.
So what I did is I had each kid, you know, grab just a big old handful of Skittles. And then I had him grab an index card. And I'm like, okay, let's make red Skittles quartz, little grains of quartz, sand. Okay. And then let's make orange Skittles feldspar. Let's make blue or yellow Skittles mica, muscovite, you know, and so on. I used like really common minerals and I assigned a color to a mineral, if that makes sense. So everybody was working with the same thing. So then I said, okay, well, let's just look at your pile that you have sitting in front of you, this un everything pile of 5 different colored Skittles. Would you call that pile in front of you well sorted? You know, and they're like, no, of course not. Right. Yep. Then I just kind of, I walked them down a path of, all right, well, let's take that pile and let's transport all of these Skittles down a stream. What's going to be the first one that goes away? Like what's not going to stand up? Right. And so we removed things like biotite and muscovite because they're so flimsy and they break down. Right. So remove those colors, whatever color I assigned to those, get them out of there. So now I have a pile that is more homogenous than what I started with. And then I just keep working down, right? And I'm like, okay, well, let's move this several dozens of miles downstream even further. Let's slow the water down and allow deposition to take place. And now what do we have? And we're going to be left with quartz and feldspar for the most part, the two like really most common minerals at the crust of the earth. And then I'm given an opportunity to talk about what happens to, what's the difference between quartz and feldspar? What happens to feldspar? Feldspar breaks down mechanically easier, but it also breaks down chemically and it turns into clay. I talk about, all right, well, I have this pile of Skittles that I have quartz and feldspar mineral grains in it, sand grains. Is that well sorted? No. Is it poorly sorted? No. Okay, now you have an Arcos.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and then I'm like, all right, well, let's go ahead and take this downstream now a long ways, and let's get all the feldspar out of there. All I have are one color Skittles. Is that well sorted? Yeah, that's well sorted. And so I use it. I'm giving you like the 10-second version of like a lesson.
Yeah, right.
A full this takes time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, but that makes sense. I mean, that's a good example. And I think I can see the reason why you would have Arco sandstone and quartz sandstone. Some people would call it aronite, you know, quartz sandstone, aronite sandstone.
Yep, quartz, aronite.
Same thing, same definition, basically. But, and I could see why you would teach those and not the wacky sandstone. And some people would call that a lithic sandstone. And I always think of lithic sandstone as it has actual fragments of rocks in them. Like the sand grains are little pieces of rocks. And that only really forms when you're like, you're on a beach, you're looking at the ocean, you turn around, and there's a volcano right there. Like, you have to be really close to the source,
or turbidite, right? You know, turbidity currents and things like this ripping down the continental
and you get
slope.
Thin and layers of sandstone in a big turbidite package or something. And they're a very different setting, basically, than what you're describing. So I what you're describing makes complete sense pedagogically to describe maturity by using these two sandstones. And that's a beautiful one. And I think it's an interesting,
it also provides me with an opportunity to, like, I have a lot of Arcos sandstone.
Okay.
And so to then say, look in the rock, what minerals do you see in this rock? Well, I see a bunch of salmon colored grains that look a lot like feldspar. And they're like, well, this is why we do minerals before we do rocks. You know, you're right on. You know, so it's another then opportunity on a one-on-one or a one-on-two setting to say, look in the rock. Don't look at the rock, but look at the pieces that are in it.
I think this also, I'm guessing, Chris, this brings you nicely into shale as well, right? Because shale's the next one. It's a dead obvious one. Like every class will teach you shale. You're going to learn shale because it's, you know, such a big, important sedimentary rock. As part of this discussion, it brings up, I guess it answers the question, where did all the feldspar and where did all the muscovite and biotite go when it got weathered out of this stream sediment? Where'd it go, right? And the answer is, it's in shale. It's in clays that end up getting brought out.
Silicate minerals chemically weather into clay.
Exactly.
And so clay can be thought of in two ways, really. Clay can be thought of as its own mineral, and it can be thought of also as a grain size. And in the case of shale, it's really both. Dust size pieces, I associate the particle size, the pieces that are in the rocks, with energy. So conglomerate and breccia, big pieces, high energy. Sandstones are going to be moderate energy. The water has slowed down. And so the pieces that the water is able to carry and subsequently deposit are smaller. And then what's smaller yet? I don't get into siltstone, Jesse, because I just frankly don't have room for it. And it's kind of transition rock. So I go straight from sandstone, moderate energy, to really calm, quiet energy, which deposits shale.
All these rocks, you bring up a really good point about all these rocks, igneous, metamorphic, sedimentary, there's gradients in between all of them. So we break them into categories because we have to. But if you look at the sediment size chart, got boulders and cobbles, there's a hard cutoff between those that is just a human thing that's made up, right? These size fractions, borders between them are just made up, right? And so obviously there's a big gradient. Same thing for metamorphic rocks, same thing for igneous rocks. I mean, that covers shale, the really low energy, but it's still detrital. It's still pieces of rock. It's pieces of minerals. That's what we use as detrital.
Now, one other thing before we move on, because I sense that you want to move on to the other kinds of rocks, but in my class too, in terms of shale, is I'll bring up a bunch of shale and I have each kid come up to the front of the room and grab a piece, and we have shale communion. They all sit down and I'm like, okay, you are free now to take a little bite out of the corner of the shale.
That's funny.
Because it's one of the ways that we do. We call it shale communion. And the shale that I'm using is some of the shale that I got from the gypsum mines in Grand Rapids time ago.
Yeah.
And so this shale also has coprolites in it, which is fossilized shark poop. So I don't tell them that till afterwards.
No, that's right. Yeah, you got to save that one till the end. But it's gritty. You know, it's hard to feel with your fingers. It's hard to feel the grits with the tips of your fingers, but you can feel it between your teeth.
Barely. It's more chalky than anything else. And it also breaks really easily, which is one of the ways that it's a weak, wimpy rock. And so that's why we bite it.
Okay, the next one, I cover it for sure because I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm curious why you cover it in Michigan. is coal.
Oh, because it's so important. It has been historically so important.
So talk about it just because societally relevant rock?
Very relevant. Yeah. I think a lot of people have seen it too. You know, everybody from Michigan travels south. So most of the people are going to travel through the Appalachian Mountains at some point, and they're going to see these seams of coals. Or if they go out west and they go through Gillette, Wyoming, they're going to see these massive seams of coal. And it's, you know, that's what bounces out of all the train cars heading to the power plant near the lakeshore.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I cover it because we're in Pennsylvania and, you know, heck, coal built America in many ways, right? I mean, the steel industry, the power industry, you know, everything. So I cover it because we're in Appalachia here. The next two, limestone, I think that one I don't have too many questions on. I mean, it's limestone. It's the big dog. It's a chemical precipitate. Like, you should know that. You covered dolostone. Dolostone is also on here. That feels like it's, I don't know, that feels like it's
No. You think so? Why?
I would just put dolostone in the gray area. I mean, coal, obviously, it's an important rock to cover, but it's not one of the big ones scientifically. Dolostone's important, but I could see leaving it out too. So what's the rationale?
Okay, I absolutely can see leaving it out, and I don't have to cover dolostone, but I feel like it's a part of... Dolostone is necessary in a class like this because it gives you separation. You have to identify in dolostone is different.
Okay.
And I want to experience that difference.
That's a great point. Just, you know, saying, okay, limestone fizzes when you drop acid on it. Dolostone, you have to scrape it to fizz. You have to get powder to fizz. Just that difference. Is that what you're talking about? Like, teaching them to be maybe a little bit meticulous.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is.
Go one step deeper than the surface, you know, test.
Yeah. If you spend 3 weeks in lab identifying rocks and you go through this, I have what I think is a bulletproof protocol for identifying rocks, these common rocks that they have to know. They get into this habit of picking them up and they're like, oh, that's what it is. And they plop it down.
Then Yeah, for sure.
And they get into this routine really quickly. And I think... I started doing this and it's kind of touchy feely and, you know, I don't know what you think about this. So I'm interested to hear this, but I started having them identify rocks with their eyes closed.
Oh, interesting. Okay. How does that go?
I want you to use your other senses, right? Because when you hold these rocks in your hands, Jesse, you and I, we've held so many rocks. They have a feel.
Yeah.
Right.
You get a sense of the weight, right? You get a feel for the density.
Absolutely. The hardness, the sharpness of the edges of the minerals, like we need to use more than just our sight when in identifying rocks. We need to use all of them. We can use taste or textural feel with in terms of biting some of them off and things like that, right? And so because I have samples in my lab that are quartz sandstone that look just like some of my samples of dolostone. They have this beautiful banding in them and so on. And if they just look at them, they don't know how to tell the difference. I'm like, well, wait, come on now.
Hold
it in your hand and rub your thumb over it. Which one feels like sandpaper? And that's a textural thing. You don't need your eyes.
No, that's true.
To identify that.
The difference, and this is like a, I think some other science fields and some of the scientists sometimes look at the terminology we use in this mineral and rock identification thing, and they're like, what the heck are you doing? But the difference that you're describing there is gritty versus waxy. And those terms, you might be listening to this and think, what are you talking about? Well, gritty, waxy in a rock. But when you rub your finger across it, you know the difference. You know the difference between sandstone and sandpaper grittiness and that dolostone or marbly waxiness to it. It's just a little bit smoother. It's a little bit kind of a greasy feel to it, right?
And that's right. And think about holding limestone in your hands, right? Limestone can be a difficult rock. It's the Katy Perry of rocks. We've talked a lot about that before. It has so many different looks. But you know what? When you hold it in your hand, limestone is made up of calcite. Calcite is a soft mineral. It is a hardness of 3 on Mohs scale of hardness. Look, you can feel that. If you hold it in your hand enough, and you're using your other senses, you're not going to think that it's something else.
I agree completely. And this is what makes geology inherently descriptive science. Saying the rock is waxy is a very non-quantitative. It's not a scientific term because you have to be specific. But ultimately, this is descriptive. And if you feel a waxy rock, you know it. It makes sense, right? So there is some aspect to this particular version of physical science that I think attracts people like me, and I think you, Chris, too, is something that attracts us to geology is this historicalness to it, this sort of descriptive storytelling nature to it. And we're kind of getting into that part of it right now in these descriptions of rocks and the differences here. So I actually really like that exercise of close your eyes and identify the rock because it tunes you into these things that you might not pay attention to, like your students. If you, Chris Bullhuis, are lecturing and say, hey, this feels waxy versus this feels gritty, those are just words that kind of go in one ear and out the other, I bet, until they have to do your exercise of close their eyes and identify it, I bet.
And until I'm standing right in front of them, I'm saying, wait a minute, close your eyes now, give me both hands. And I plop one rock in, a different rock in each hand. And I'm like, okay, well, now tell me what you feel.
That's a great...
Use your other senses.
That is a great exercise. I like that a lot.
And I think that's really nice. That's a beautiful thing. That's the way science should be. Science should be hands-on, and it should be using as many of our senses as possible.
Totally. Agree completely. Okay, that's dolostone limestone. I don't really have many questions about sort of what you don't cover in the sediments, but I do in the metamorphic rocks. So maybe let's move to that. And I think, Chris, we can probably move pretty quickly through the ones you do cover because these are the bog standard metamorphic rocks. Would you agree with that? Like, I don't know, maybe I'll just list them and we can kind of talk about them. And the order is
list them in an order that makes sense though. You know what I mean when I say that.
So, yeah, for sure. So I'm going to go from low grade, quote unquote grade, to high grade, meaning low metamorphic intensity to high metamorphic intensity. And that goes, well, there's two categories, two flavors, two families of metamorphic rocks. There's the foliated ones and the unfoliated. I'm going to focus on the foliated ones, the one that have, if you pick it up in your hand, you'll feel banding in it and stuff. Low grade is slate, higher grade is phyllite. Higher than that, we go to schist, and then the highest would be gneiss. And we kind of, I think it's pretty clear, more intense metamorphism, it kind of stands out. Chris, would you agree with that? That like going through those rocks, you look at them or you close your eyes and feel them and you feel more metamorphism. Is that right or not?
I think so. These lower grade metamorphic rocks like slate and even phyllite, they just don't look sedimentary anymore. Their parent rock is sedimentary, you know, like slate, the parent rock is probably going to be shale. And so if shale is made of clay, but if you subject that to low grade heat and pressure, the clay minerals, they recrystallize into mica. And mica is this really beautiful, everybody knows it's the one that my kids love to destroy in lab. They peel it apart into thin sheets. You know, I just leave a mess all over the place. But actually, in the case of slate has a glossy sheen to it because these are microscopic.
Let me interrupt real quick. The difference that I say is shale, if you pick it up and you tap it against the table, like tap it against the edge of the table, it's going to break. It's going to start flaking off, breaking apart. If you take slate won't if you're just tapping it. If you hit it a little bit harder, a little bit more force, it'll start to break. Phyllite will not if you start to hit it a little bit harder, right? Phyllite's actually kind of hard to break. So that kind of go like, are you tapping it? If it breaks, it's still shale. If it doesn't break, then it might be slate. If you tap it hard and it breaks, it's probably slate and not phyllite. And, you know, it's just that they're like slightly better put together, I guess. Slightly bigger grains.
And another thing too about phyllite. Phyllite's a beautiful rock, by the way. I think you and I both are in love with phyllite. It's also, this is subjective, but it's glossier.
Yep,
than
it is totally
slate.
Definitely is.
You know, and it has this really, and it's
smooth.
Really easy to
feels
see
smooth
when you hold
too.
Them next to each other. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then we go to schist, where we actually get to start to see mineral grains popping out. There's, if you see garnets in it, it's usually a schist.
We love schist.
We have some, actually, Chris, you know, do you remember the starlight schist we collected in
yes,
the Black
I do.
Hills?
Starlight crosses. That's
beautiful.
Right.
Yeah. So I have a piece of this. I'm excited about this. I'm excited for you to come visit Pennsylvania because you get to see this. I have a big piece of this. I mean, it's probably a meter and a half long. It's kind of like a needle-like one, which one face has beautiful starlight crosses in it. I've never really known what to do with this rock because it's kind
wasn't
of...
Wasn't that with you when you got it?
Yeah. And you have a similar piece. I think you have it kind of standing up as a column in your yard, if I remember correctly, like in this beautiful starlight crosses just on one side. And the other three sides are kind of crappy. So I've decided I'm going to make an end table out of this, where I'm going to cut the bottom off of the Starlight Cross, and it's going to be standing up. And then I'm going to have a piece of wood, a single piece of wood, a side and a top that I'm going to join together in a 90 degree. And then I'm just going to set the wood on top of the schist. And so the schist is going to kind of be the base for the table and poke up through the table a little bit. And then have this like nice wood top on top of it with the Starlight really good crosses facing out. Yeah. It's going to be totally cool, I think. But
I'd be nervous about cutting it only because the foliation makes it like difficult.
It's true.
And kind of nuanced to cut.
That's true. And it brings that back to our point here, is that schist is not the highest grade rock. It's still foliated. It still can break. You know, the grains are pretty well put together, but it can certainly break. And then gneiss is when we start to get light and dark mineral segregations. I love gneisses because that's what I work on.
That's beautiful.
They're higher grade, more intense metamorphism. Those are the foliated ones. Those are the four. Slate, fillet, schist, gneiss. The unfoliated, the non-foliated rocks are marble and quartzite. And those are just really simple. I mean, marble is metamorphosed limestone or sometimes dolostone, but it's just recrystallized. The grains don't orient themselves. Calcite doesn't orient itself, so it just is solid, big, beautiful rock. Quartzite is just metamorphosed sandstone. The quartz grains are just interlocking now. And it doesn't have that gritty feel. Yeah, it doesn't have that gritty feel. It kind of chips. It's got a chippy feel, not a gritty feel, is the difference.
So what are your questions then?
Well, let's cover the
last, because I know you have a few.
Let's cover the last one, number seven, that you do cover. You brought it up right at the outset, is metaconglomerate. Okay, you said, I think you brought up a really good point. Metaconglomerate is, as the name implies, metamorphosed conglomerate. You said that it might be on the exam because it's common in Michigan, which I think is a really good point. And you and I have spent a lot of time looking after some metaconglomerates, digging yes, around in gravel pits.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we have. Absolutely. Yeah.
How do you teach metaconglomerate?
It's really, to me, I think it's self-explaining. It was a conglomerate. That was the protolith. That was the parent rock. And then it got metamorphosed, heat and pressure, and it turned it in. So we call it a metaconglomerate. It's more colloquial, I think, to refer to it that way. Or don't you think, right? We do the same thing with metabasalt, you know, with these like low-grade chlorite schists that we see all over in the UP. And yeah, I don't know. I that's how I kind of talk about it.
I think that's,
if that makes sense.
I think that's probably right. And I think you're right. It's very common in Michigan, and because there's a huge swaths of metaconglomerate up in Canada, just north of Michigan, that got swept down by the glaciers. Pudding stone. People have heard the term pudding, like P-U-D-D-I-N-G stone, pudding stone. It's a metaconglomerate. It has chert as cobbles in it. And that's what you and I have sort of looked at or looked for quite a bit. It's a common rock in the Midwest. Oh, it's a stunningly beautiful rock, but it would be technically a metaconglomerate. So the questions are, the ones that are not on here that I actually spend a decent, probably too much time talking about in class, are things like eclogite and blue schist. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Why do I not have those?
Yeah. Or just like, what are your thoughts on it? Is it too in the weeds or?
No. I don't think so. So I have some thoughts on this actually, but no, I don't. And if you tell me, Chris, you need to add blue schist and eclogite to your sets, then I will. I absolutely will. But, you know, Jesse, like, tell me what you think about this. But a lot of intro geology textbooks, like the textbook I teach from, well, I'm not a book teacher, but right. I use
no,
it.
No, you're definitely right? not a book you know? Teacher. Yeah. See above, we created our own book in the Camp Geo.
That's absolutely true. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. But, Jesse, they don't touch upon eclogite and blue schist and the importance of them, because I they're really important, but they teach kind of these regionally metamorphosed rocks a little bit wrong. And this is something that you and I have been touching upon in recent episodes, is it too soon to talk about this stuff in an introductory level class, right? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It makes complete sense. And something, the way you just phrased that really struck me. You described it as like teaching these regional geology or regional metamorphic rocks, meaning slate, fillet, schist, gneiss, like regional metamorphism, basically. And there's something amiss teaching that as a process, because those names, the way those names are derived, they're just textural. Whereas granite is a compositional name, granite has a composition embedded in it. Granite means it's got quartz and two feldspars in it, and it's a light colored felsic igneous rock. Like, that's embedded in the name. Gneiss is just a textural classification. It has nothing to do with composition or mode of formation, really.
Well, kind of it does, though, because in order to get this really embedded foliation in these rocks, you do need to have differential stress.
That's true.
You need a directional pressure. So it does tell something tectonically that is important.
That's a good point. I think what I would love, and I understand, well, I partially understand why this is taught the way it is and not the way that I'm going to propose here. But I wish that we embedded a little bit more process into the metamorphic rocks that we include here. Like, what I'm thinking is, isn't it much more important to know that an eclogite is a subduction zone system rock? Like, it only forms in subduction zones. And a granulite is a rock that has had melt. It's been metamorphosed to such a degree that it's lost 30% of what it used to be to melting. And it's lost a granite, and now it's a granulite. Like, isn't that a more, I don't know, a process-based way of teaching these things a little bit? Like, I don't know.
It is 100%. I agree with you 100%. I like this. So, two thoughts on this. One, I don't teach those rocks to my students because Dr. Maddox does not have them on the exam. You know, and I feel like I already have a lot.
Oh, you do. Yeah. I mean, you have more than I, let me just frame this. I don't teach the Penn State class this way. Because again, I teach a class that the engineers, the mining engineers need for accreditation. So there's a certain skill set that I have to sort of teach to. There's a certain credentialing that I have to teach to, right? And everybody in the Penn State system has to teach to that. And so we're kind of bound by the structures that are in place, the sort of quote-unquote traditional thinking on this, I would say.
But I think it is also, it's really ingrained in intro-level geology that it is slate, phyllite, schist, and gneiss, and sometimes migmatite.
Yeah, you know? That's right. And
it's just like that is typical subduction zone, convergent boundary, lots of heat, lots of pressure, and it shows you grades of metamorphism. And I think that's what we're talking about. So my second proposal, and you don't know what I'm going to say here, but I'm serious about this. We're getting long in the tooth on today's episode anyway. Why don't we record our next episode to be an episode devoted to how we think teaching metamorphic rocks should change?
I think that's a good idea. I think that's a good idea because, as you said, the typical way, there's some major flaws to it. For instance, I'm an igneous petrologist. You know, I love igneous rocks. I don't see a ton of major flaws in the list of rocks that you teach, for instance, or I teach. I teach
maybe the
same
interpretations
ones.
Are going to need some tweaking over time, but
yeah, that's right. You know, because we had this interesting discussion with Mike Axton. Yeah, right. You know, but those are the rocks. Those are the important rocks. Metamorphic rocks, there's definitely some tweaking that could be done there. Sedimentary, those are the basic sedimentary rocks. Those are the important ones, right? And importantly, let me just go through the list here again. Igneous rocks are granite, rhyolite, diorite, andesite, gabbro, basalt, obsidian, pumice, scoria, and peridotite. If you know those rocks, you know the vast majority of processes that occur in the igneous processes of Earth. The sedimentary rocks are conglomerate, breccia, quartz sandstone, arkose sandstone, shale, coal, limestone, dolostone. If you know those rocks, you know most of the sedimentary processes, at least at the intro level. You know the sedimentary processes that matter. The metamorphic rocks, gneiss, schist, phyllite, slate, marble, quartzite, metic, conglomerate. I would argue you're missing about five key processes that occur in the metamorphic system of Earth.
And I would agree with you.
Even though those are really important rocks, we might be leaving out some really important processes that we could add color to in the intro by just replacing a couple of these. I'm not sure.
Well, let's do it. Let's do an episode. Let's do a follow-up episode on how we think the teaching of metamorphic rocks needs to change.
You know what, Chris? This sounds like another late night record with a whiskey and get a little rambly and just philosophical about it because we don't know. I like it.
Well,
I think
we do know. I think we do know, actually. Just not enough people ask us what we think.
Well, here's the deal. This is our podcast, so we say what we want on it. This is our right. time to talk now.
You got that right.
I think that's right. And I think, you know what, Chris, at the end of that, we're going to make a lot more work for ourselves because we're going to have to go back and re-record the metamorphic chapter of the Camp Geo book, and or at least add to it, right? Add some color to it.
I don't know. We did, though. We did talk about blue schist and eclogite.
We certainly did. I think we're going to end this discussion. Like, I'm kind of feeling this right now with this whole discussion is I want to talk about more. I want to talk more about igneous rocks. I want to add, it sucks to teach. And okay, let's end with this question. Here's the 25 rocks you teach. We just listed them. 25 rocks that Chris Belhuis teaches, the 25 rocks that you need to know as a basic intro level geologist going out there. What are some big things you feel like you wish you could talk about more? What rock types? And we can save this for another episode because we're getting, like you said, long in the tooth, but what's the one rock that you wish was added to this list?
See, I don't know if I could answer. If I had two, I would probably say eclogite and blue schist.
Okay. Because
those would be the two.
Yeah. Is there anything that is just like a wow factor, like a, oh, that's cool factor that would like rope students into geology by?
I think so. I think that, and this is the difficult part, you know, we're kind of branded rocks for jocks. You've heard that before, I'm sure, a lot. And, or why do
just
we need to know
just to
rocks?
Explain that, I don't, that's a reference to geology being the cheap, easy science that the athletes or the kids who want an easy science class, aka the jocks, take geology because it's the easy science credit. So that's the sort of source of that term.
And maybe that's a bad reference, but it's out there. It's a stereotype, definitely. But I get this more with freshman level high school students where they say, why do we need to know rock? I don't encounter that with my geology class because it's elective. And so most of my kids are there because they want to be. But we need to do a good job of, like, it's not identifying the rocks. We need to be able to identify rocks to be able to interpret the planet that we live on. It's just a big part of it. And I love where we live. I think we live in an amazing place. It's so beautiful. The rocks tell the story. How can that not be exciting? I just don't understand. And so that's the wow factor for me is like just being deliberate about making sure they don't allow themselves to slip in the routine of I'm just naming rocks. Yeah. That's all I'm doing.
No, that's right.
You know, there's a point to this.
Yeah, I think that's wise. I mean, what comes to mind for me is something like I wish there was an extra lecture in my class or something to talk about something like, I'm just thinking on the fly here, I think like banded iron formation. This rock where you look at it and you're just like, holy crap, nature can actually produce something this beautiful. Like to me, that's just it's an unbelievable rock. And it's amazing that the natural world creates something that pretty. And so that's kind of like a hook, you know, for intro people who are taking the class for the easy science credit. It's maybe a way to kind of hook them and say, look at this. This is cool. We're going to talk about how nature makes rocks that are this beautiful.
I don't see a reason why you could not carve that out as a part of your class, because it's also one of the most important rocks
to
humanity.
Is I already spend 30% of the class talking about igneous rocks, which is way too much. So, you know, I run myself out of time by blathering on about igneous rocks for too long. But it is. It's a super important rock. But that goes into the category of rocks you don't need to know. We'll talk about that later. But here's the ones. Let me just list them for the end here, Chris. The rocks you need to know, the 25 rocks you need to know. Granite, rhyolite, diorite, andesite, gabbro, basalt, obsidian, pumice, scoria, peridotite. That's the igneous rocks. The sedimentary rocks are conglomerate, breccia, quartz sandstone, arkose sandstone, shale, coal, limestone, dolostone. And rounding it out with metamorphic rocks, gneiss, schist, phyllite, slate, marble, quartzite, metic conglomerate. That's a heck of a good list, Chris. I mean, ultimately, we have some, you know, we have room for improvement. There's like gray areas here. We could pick, we could take things out and put them back in. But I mean, if you know those rocks, you're going to be a very, you know, well-functioning geologist out there. So
I think so. It sets you up for whatever you have coming down the road.
Absolutely. I think. I agree completely. Hey, Chris, that's a wrap. I mean, we'll talk about the rocks you maybe would want to know, but don't need to know later on. And let's talk about this metamorphic rocks thing. This would be super interesting. You can follow us. Go to our website, planetgeocast.com. You can support us. There's two ways to support us. We appreciate both of them. The first is go to the first link in your show notes. It's the Camp Geo app. Listen to our free physical geology course in audiobook form. You can also purchase audiobooks on the geology of Yellowstone and the geology of the Grand Canyon and Earth's climate. Just go to the first link in your show notes, download the Camp Geo app, and you'll get access to all that stuff. You can also head over to our website, planetgeocast.com, and there's a support us link. Send us an email with any of your questions at planetgeocast@gmail.com.
Cheers.
Peace.